Good morning, everybody. So I will call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today is Tuesday, March 25th, 2025. A lot of 25s in there. Anyway, a quorum is present. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes of March 20th, 2025. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have reviewed the minutes and move them.
All right. Thank you. Representative Finke moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Finke. So we have a very full agenda today, and I just want to note that everyone, the testifiers who've signed up in advance have been all have been told that they have a two-minute time limit for a testimony. And also we're asking all the bill authors and testifiers to keep their remarks to the parts of the bill that are within the judiciary's jurisdiction. We are kind of a unique committee in that respect. We get lots and lots of bills that we only really need to review part of. And if we start reviewing every other committee's work, we will never complete our work. So we're going to really try to keep it tight on that. So the first bill on the agenda for today is House File 102, Representative Curran. And Representative Curran, the motion is going to be that House File 102 be re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Is that right, Representative Curran?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
Wonderful. Okay. And we don't have an amendment, so we can get right to the presentation of the bill. Representative Curran.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Chair Lievely and Chair Scott. House File 102 is actually a bill that I am authoring and carrying forward through the process, but Chair Scott has also authored the same exact version this year and last year, I think. So it's a completely bipartisan bill, mostly a technical fix. House File 102 allows public authorities to use the option of terminating a redirection of child support obligation when it's in the best interest of the child or children. It's a technical fix to a law that was passed in 2022. This allows or adds new language allowing termination of redirection, again, if it's no longer in the best interest of the child as determined by statute. I am working with Ramsey County Attorney Office, or the Ramsey County Attorney's Office on this, but this will affect every county across the state. With that, I will turn it over to my testifier, Trish, the Child Support Services Director at Ramsey County.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Trish Skolphammer with Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I'm the Director of the Child Support Services Division. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for giving us this opportunity to explain what we consider a technical fix. There's currently a statute in the child support section that allows for redirecting child support when a child is living either with a caregiver, such as with a grandparent, or if the child is in foster care. In 2022, there was legislation passed that provided for when a child is in foster care, parents and the income and resources of the child can be used to reimburse the cost of foster care. And we added a provision there that it can only be done, that reimbursement can only be done when it's considered to be in the child's best interest. Child support is often redirected under this redirection statute under the child support section, and it can be done administratively with proper notice to the parties, and it can also be terminated administratively with proper notice to the parties. What we want to do now is just add a provision that allows us to terminate that redirection when it's not in the best interest of the child pursuant to the cost of care statute. So it connects those two statutes and allows us to terminate those redirections and get that money flowing back into a family, which is really helpful when a child is coming home from foster care and relieving the family from that debt. And it prevents us from having to go to court and then would give agencies clear authority that they can terminate that redirection.
Okay, thank you. I don't think you have any more testifiers, Representative Curran, right? Is there anyone from the public who wants to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone. Member discussion. Is anybody awake this morning? All right, seeing no discussion, do you want to finish up, Representative Curran?
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling and Co-Chair Scott. Yes, this is a technical amendment. For folks that are curious, if you look at line 2.4 of existing language, somebody can already try to contest redirection of support if it is not in the best interest of the child. So it's essentially just putting this in alignment that if redirection is not in the best interest of the child, that we could move forward with that process. So
I appreciate the committee's time. All right, thank you. So Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 102 be re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you. Next will be House File 1354, Representative Mohler. And Representative Mohler's motion is going to be that House File 1354 be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. And there is a DE1 amendment. And I assume, Representative Mohler, that you want to move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the order in which you want to discuss it?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And do you want to give us a few words about what you're doing with the DE1?
So it would probably be easier if I explain it because it is what the bill's doing as well, but I'll note that the DE is what the Senate added to their bill, I believe, on Friday, and we are fine with it, and the BCA is fine with it as well.
All right. So, so let's adopt the DE1, and then we'll go from there. Any discussion to the DE1? All of, in favor of adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, so to your bill as amended, Representative Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Scott, and members of the committee. So currently the BCA is required to post to its website all public data from officer-involved death investigations within 30 days of the end of the appeals period. This bill modifies that requirement slightly by requiring that the video of the incident, only the video that shows the events leading up to and of the incident, have to be posted within 30 days. As Superintendent Evans will explain, there are a lot of body cam videos these days, and a lot of them are things that aren't as relevant to the incident. And so this really just simplifies that process. It's still, those other things would still be available. They just don't need to be posted to the website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Superintendent Evans.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, members of the committee, for considering this bill. As Chair Mohler explained in this process, what we're simply trying to do
Oh, excuse me. Need to state your name. I forgot to ask you to do that.
Yeah. I should have known that, Chair. I apologize. I am Drew Evans, Superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, is what I lead currently. And so I thank you for that reminder, Chair. What this does is it limits the amount of information that needs to be posted on our website. We support, and in the interest of transparency and the public interest in officer-involved death investigations, that all of the information get posted on our website. What we've encountered is we've been working to try to comply with this law is there's a lot of what we're referring to as extraneous video. A lot of law enforcement agencies now will have their body cams running from the time they enter a crime scene to the time they leave. It's really not documenting anything of interest that the public wants to see. It's them providing perimeter security, a variety of different things. And so what we're trying to do is limit those videos that they still retain their data classification under 13825 with body cams and other video. But what we would be required to post is those circumstances, as Chair Mohler noted, surrounding the events leading up to it, the actual use of force, and then a short period after that occurs until medical attention is often provided, and then it would be cut. The member of the public can still make a request after the fact. It would go into our normal queue for complying with data practices requests. What's happening is oftentimes, as you can imagine, there's a lot of movement with body cams. We have to redact them by hand because most of that data is private data in terms of other people that might be captured, and so we have to blur them. That is just taking an extreme amount of time for us to do, and we're not meeting that 30 days. The vast majority of the public and people interested in these cases want to see the information we can get to relatively quickly, the full file, the interviews, the photographs, the transcripts, the reports, and the video of the actual incident. And so we'll get that up within that time frame. I'll just note for the community, we have 9 people full-time that their sole job is to work in compliance with data practices requests at the BCA, and they cannot keep up because of the volume that we're seeing. So this is what we consider a fairly small modification that, again, remains that. And the amendment that was offered in the Senate clarifies exactly the circumstances that are to be put on the public website and is a little cleaner, and then also ensuring that it's clear that nothing in this is circumventing Chapter 13 or Minnesota Data Practices Act, so that it's very clear that the data classification remains the same. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers with you? Okay. So is there anyone from the public who wants to testify on the bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'd like to thank Dana Goetz, Drew Evans, and Senator Carlson and Representative Mueller for taking the amendment. The amendment was done to make sure that all data is available to the public. As you said, after the tragic death of Mr. George Floyd back in 2020, this is a good bill. It helps, it keeps up transparency, sunshine. So, Madam Chair, I thank you very much, and I thank those parties that I said for cooperating for clarity of language. It's important.
All right. And did you state your name for the record?
Rich Neumeister.
Okay.
My name is.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Mueller, for bringing the bill, and Superintendent Evans. I just want to it's just a comment. Thank you for continuing to be an open and willing partner to work on this, to do what's best for your department, also what's best for the community and the public, and accessing this data. So thank you.
Thank you. Other comments or questions from members? All right. Seeing none, final words, Representative Mueller.
It's a good bill. Please vote yes. Thank you.
Okay. So you've got experience here. Okay. All right. So Representative Mueller renews her motion that House File 1354 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee as amended. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you. All right. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1082, Representative Mueller and Representative Rarick. And let's see, 1082. So the motion, I think Representative Mueller's motion is that House File 1082 be referred back to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Right, that will be the motion.
It's my motion, Chair.
Thank you. And there is an author's amendment, the A2. And did you want to move the A2, Representative Mueller?
I will move the A2. And the A2 adds to the special revenue account that we created with House File 1082.
Okay. Is there discussion or questions to the A2? All right, let's adopt the A2. All in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. So to the bill as amended. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Scott and members of the committee. So House File 1082 is a bill to provide more sustainable funding for victim services programs in our state. These programs provide crucial services to victims and survivors of crime, like domestic violence, shelters and advocates, sexual assault advocates, child abuse centers, general crime advocates, and more. And these services, or the funding for these services, is largely from federal dollars. That's been decreasing over the years, and it's not getting any better. We tried to put some Band-Aids on it in 2023. We thought it was the situation was going to improve federally. It comes from crimes, and so it's sort of an unstable funding source, and it didn't get any better. It's actually gotten a little bit bleaker. And so we're trying to, with this bill, create a special revenue account where we can put different things into this account to provide some more sustainable state funding. And so one of those things, and the reason why it came to this committee, was increasing the marriage license fee by $10. And then with the amendment we just put on, we'd be increasing fines for certain types of convictions. And of course, it's based on, not necessarily based on ability to pay, but if someone's indigent, they wouldn't be required to pay. And even then, if it's a difficult circumstance, the judge would have discretion to not impose that extra fine. But the idea is that money would all get rolled into a special revenue account to help pay for these victim services programs. And I do have one testifier, and Chair Rarick has also been very helpful and supportive of victim services over the years, and so I'm happy to present side by side with her, and I expect she'll have some comments as well.
Wonderful. Welcome, Chair Rarick. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So what's really important about this is the volatility. So I have some information, and you have it in front of you, too. The VOCA funds, you know, they were established in 1984, so they've been around a very long time. But the thing is if you look at the last, so if you got your sheet in front of you, it is in 23, it was $1.8 billion. In 24, it was even more bleak, $1.2 billion federally, so overall. And the high was $3.85 billion in 18. So it's very, very, very volatile. And it affects the services here in Minnesota tremendously. I've got some in my district that serve not just Wright County, but counties surrounding. And so it's really important for rural Minnesota, the metro. It's important for everybody to have this fund be stable.
And excuse me, and Chair Rarick? Chair Rarick? Yes, ma'am. I think we're having trouble finding what document you're.
Oh, it's just the House summary.
Oh, it's the House summary. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Just why I see I'm shuffling around. I see other members doing that, so thank you.
I apologize, Chair Liebling. So if you just look at the nonpartisan House summary, it's got a great little overview. Yeah. And so you can see what I just said right there.
Perfect.
It's just really helpful to kind of put it in perspective and understand the highs and the lows. And interestingly, I think, too, that this money comes federally from fines and penalties. And now with the amendment that we added, it also does that in Minnesota. So those that are causing and inflicting the pain are the ones that are going to fill the fund. And I think that's a nice parallel. That's all I have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, and we have another testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Becca Muscat. I'm the Associate Director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. I'm here today on behalf of all six Minnesota crime victim coalitions who are listed in the letter provided to you. Together, our coalitions represent over 150 crime victim services organizations across Minnesota. Crime victim advocates are a crucial part of many survivors' safety and healing journey. Crime victim services in Minnesota have struggled to maintain stable funding that keeps up with inflation and rising costs. Currently, the single largest source of funding for crime victim services are state and federal grants. The main source of federal funds, the Crime Victim Fund through the Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA, has steadily declined since 2017, with a 40% cut to the state last year and similar cut expected this year. In the last competitive grant funding cycle, the Office of Justice Programs received over $100 million in requests for grant funding by crime victim service programs. That is the need to provide quality, sustainable crime victim services in Minnesota. We need to do something different if we want to change the trajectory of crime victim services. We do not want to come before you each year to ask for one-time funding. We see a better way, a way that allows our work to be more about prevention, a way to provide full wraparound services to our clients instead of the emergency approach currently undertaken due to limited funding, a way to regain the number of domestic violence shelter beds statewide instead of closing due to funding shortages, a way to provide culturally specific services so that our efforts are effective, meaningful, and change the trajectory of one's life for the better. The better way is presented to you today in the form of long-term revenue-generating solutions. These funding streams build on the one-time funding allocated over the current biennium and the one-time funding we need again in the next biennium to get us on the other side of implementing these long-term solutions. The coalitions will continue to identify viable options to feed into the proposed Crime Victim Services Special Revenue Fund. Please take the step forward with us in creating long-term sustainable funding streams that reduce our dependence on the state general fund. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
All right, thank you. You have no further testifiers, right? Okay. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone. So we'll go to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thanks for this bill. I think it's really important to have some stable funding. And one of my questions is there's no fiscal note here. Are you Do you have estimates on how much money this will annually or biannually bring in?
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Chair Scott, for that question. So we keep requesting fiscal notes as we add in the other things. So that has been requested. I don't think the marriage license fee that we added on when we initially talked about that will generate a ton of revenue. The idea is, though, any little amount helps. The corporate crime piece that was already in the bill as well, that's modeled after California did something similar. And corporate crimes aren't necessarily that common. They do happen, and there is the potential for a lot of money to come in a fine from that source, but that wouldn't be sustainable either. And then what we amended on today with respect to the crimes, I think would probably be a little bit steadier. But again, I don't have an estimate for how much that would bring. I don't think that this alone will solve the problem, especially in like the short term. We're still going to need to do some other things, but the idea is that these can build and that we can keep thinking of other ideas and ways to put money into this count.
Representative Scott?
Thank you for that answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the funding source from marriage license fees. It's my understanding that previously, the Family Resiliency Project, which we heard a bill to fund them, was the only organization that was getting money from that particular source. My question is, are we potentially opening the door to expanding that particular form of revenue by opening it up to other projects that we're going to be funding, or has there been any caution given as to, you know, protecting that funding source for that existing project?
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for that question. I think Chair Scott could answer. I think there might be other sources of that fund, but I will say with respect to the $10 fee we're adding on, we were trying to think of things that are correlated, and of course, intimate partner violence is a problem. So we felt like this was a logical place to add a fee, just given the relationship between intimate partner violence and whether or not someone's married or not. And so that's why we went to this source, and I don't know if she can answer the question about current funds.
Did you want to answer,
Representative
Scott? Sure.
Yeah, I can give some idea there. So the Family Resiliency Project, they've gotten funding out of marriage and divorce filing fees for a number of years. They're asking, I think, for it to go from $25 to $35. The general fund gets some money. There's a project for marriage counselors at the University of Minnesota. I think they get $2 out of every. So there's, you'd be surprised if you look at where all the marriage and divorce fees, filing fees go. It's like there's probably five or six different items. And so, but I, when the resiliency folks were here, they weren't increasing the fee. They were just taking, there would be less money going to the general fund by $10 or whatever it was, 10 or 20 bucks out of every fee. So that whole thing is kind of a patchwork, and I've kind of looked into it a little bit to make sure that the money that's being spent for the funding at the U and all those things are still really valid purposes for that money. So I hope that answers your question. Thank you,
Representative Hudson, anything further? Okay. Other questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none. So with that then, Representative Moeller is going to renew her motion that House File 1082, as amended, be re-referred back to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and it is done. Okay. Next up, we have House File 2184, Representative Feist. And Representative Feist's motion is that House File 2184 be placed on the General Register. Correct, Representative Feist? That's your motion? Great, okay. So I don't think there's an amendment for this one, so I think we can go ahead. And Representative Feist, welcome, and please present your bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. This bill is to ensure that when the ombudsperson for the American Indian Families needs to send a letter to the court about possible violations of the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, or ICWA and MIFPA, no filing fees are charged. The office does not have funds in its very limited budget to pay these fees. And my testifier, Ombudsperson Jill Kehulani-Esh, will provide more details about the importance of being able to provide important information to the court, since ICWA and MIFPA are very unique areas of law. And with that, I will turn it over.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello and good morning. Jill Kehulani-Esh, Ombudsperson with the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families, the only independent state agency of its kind in the nation. Thank you very much to this legislature for passing that in 2021. The Indian Child Welfare Act and Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act is a very unique area of the law, which only pertains to American Indian and Alaska Native children and youth who are in out-of-home placement. When I am contacted or I learn of a case in juvenile court or family court in which ICWA and MIFPA would apply, and I determine based on my investigation that there are violations, I write a letter to the court. As a licensed attorney, I can write a letter to the court. My letter to the court is not to advocate, but to shine a light on the applicable law or laws. Currently, the law requires a filing fee to file this letter. We're asking the law be changed to waive the court filing fees, like how the fees are waived for tribes and guardians ad litem. I have been the ombudsperson since 2013, and we have written letters over the past decade. Some judges waive the court filing fees, but some do not. If the letter is not filed, I have seen that the courts have referred to the letter on the light that I shone as to why the court, for example, should not terminate a parent's rights because notice had not been provided to the tribe. Some county judges have waived the fees, but some have not. And when, for the cases that they have not, I've tried to do a workaround by getting another party to submit my letter to the court by attaching it to their letter and referring it to an exhibit. So this is a very important law. Tribes have, tribes' fees are waived, and so the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families, we're also looking to have our filing fees waived. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers, Representative Feist? Okay. Is there anyone from the public who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Discussion? Members, questions? Comments? All right, well, I just will comment. I think this makes a lot of sense, and thank you for bringing the bill, and thank you for being here. Thank you for your work in the courts, and I'm delighted that the state is doing this, and it just seems like this is an oversight that we probably should have taken care of before when we actually set up the ombudsman's office. So thank you very much. So with that, Representative Feist is going to renew the motion that House File 2184 be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you.
Mahalo.
All right. Next, we have House File 1792, Representative Mahmoud, and Representative Mahmoud's motion is that House File 1792 be placed on the general register, correct? And there is an amendment. And did you want to move the amendment? Let's see.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd like to have the amendment moved.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Mahmoud will move the amendment. I don't know. Do we have, I don't think I have an amendment.
Oh, I passed it.
Oh, you did. Okay. So this was the amendment was passed out separately for members who are trying to find it, the A1. And it changes, it updates effective dates, correct? So so any discussion to the A1 amendment? It was passed out separately? Representative Duran, it was, should have been like kind of on top of your pile when you sat down. If you need another copy. No? Got it? Okay. All right. I know we're moving kind of quickly here, so I want to make sure everybody has what has. Please let me know if you don't have what you need. You know, we'll pause and make sure you get it. Representative Mahmoud has moved the A1. Did you want to just say anything about the A1, Representative Mahmoud, before we adopt it?
So this amendment was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Realtors. It simply changes the key effective dates from the following final enactment to August 1st, 2025, to give the association time to educate their members.
Okay, very good. Any discussion to the amendment? All right, all in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended.
Thank you. Last year, my predecessor, former Representative Holden Hessen, carried a bill that made major reforms to our contract for deed law. This bill was in response to widespread problems that surfaced regarding predatory practices that investors and speculators were engaging in against all contract for deed buyers, especially those in the Somali and Latino community. This bill focused in on these practices perpetrated by those in the business of contract for deed who were bilking unsuspecting home buyers. The bill left intact those so-called mom-and-pop sales, that is, sales by one individual to another, a parent to a child, or a landlord to a long-time renter. Over the interim, several technical errors were identified. In addition to two additional categories of sales that should be exempt were identified. This bill is primarily technical. The two substantive changes are the addition of two new exempt groups, the first state and political subdivisions, and a sole owner LLC whose owner is a natural person otherwise exempt. This bill has been vetted with stakeholders from last year's bill, among them being the Minnesota Association of Realtors, the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Minnesota Land Title Association, and the Minnesota Banker Association and the Credit Union Network. So I have Ron Elwood from Legal Aid with me to answer any questions on the bill.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Elwood, did you want to make comments or do you want to, or are you just here for questions?
Madam Chair, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'm happy to answer questions. I don't think it's a very technical bill, but I would just like to thank the committee administrators and House counsel for all their help on this bill and, frankly, every bill we've worked on this year, and we really appreciate that. And I want to thank Representative Mahmoud for agreeing to carry this cleanup bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. People are fleeing when I ask that. Okay. So open for discussion then, member discussion. Okay, yeah, we're kind of quiet today. I don't know. Maybe we need to serve coffee at this table or something. Okay, so seeing no discussion, final words, Representative Mahmoud.
Committee members, thank you for your time, and please do support my bill.
All right, so Representative Mahmoud renews her motion that House File 1792, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is going to the General Register. Thank you. Okay, I think we are going to skip past the next. The Representative Howard is presenting in another committee. So if we can, we'll go to Representative Elkins' bill, House File 2429. And Representative Elkins is here with House File 2429, and the motion will be to lay the bill over. So Representative Elkins, why don't you go ahead? There is an amendment in the packet, but we'll go ahead and introduce your bill, and then we'll bring up the amendment later on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2429 is a portion of the governor's anti-fraud package. Specifically, the bill empowers state agencies to narrowly share information to facilitate in investigations of fraud. And it's particular interest to me in reading the OLA's report on the frontline worker pay. One of the things that the OLA pointed out is that checks had not been made to the Department of Revenue to confirm income, or to the Department of Health for to check the that the person was still alive. And in response, the agencies observed that, well, in the bill authorizing that program, the legislature had authorized certain data sharing, but it had not specifically authorized data sharing of those particular kinds. So the intention of this bill is essentially to make it clear that state agencies, when they are doing their own program administration and auditing, have access to the data that they need in order to make sure that that the program is being administered in a way to minimize fraud. So with me today is Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Administration, Stacy Christensen. So Stacy's office, among other things, interprets the Data Practices Act for state agencies. She's also one of the state's leading experts on data sharing. She is a co-chair of the Minute Technical Advisory Commission Work Group on Data Sharing, where we serve together. And so she is here to provide details and answer questions as well.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stacy Christensen, I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. The data sharing in this bill that Representative Elkins described is part of the governor's anti-fraud package and provides an additional tool in the state's toolbox to prevent fraud in state government programs. In a nutshell, the bill strengthens the authority for state agencies to share data with one another related to suspected or confirmed fraud in public programs, if the access promotes the protection of public resources, promotes the integrity of public programs, or aids in the law enforcement process. The importance for this data sharing provision hinges on the need for state agencies to effectively communicate and collaborate with one another and to streamline reporting processes, specifically related to preventing fraud in public programs. This language is narrowly drafted for the specified purpose and does not allow for sharing of data when specifically prohibited by law. While a variety of authorities currently exist in law to legally share data between agencies for specified purposes, the need to prevent fraud in public programs is of such importance that this new provision within the Data Practices Act, applying to all government entities, is necessary to provide a streamlined approach to meet this common goal. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you. Representative Elkins, did you have any other testifiers?
No.
Okay. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Mr. Neumeister, please come forward. State your name for the record, and please proceed.
I'll remember that. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. As many of you know, I wear two basic hats in all my years here, the privacy hat and the public open records hat. I'm wearing the privacy hat today. Data sharing is important, but I don't believe what this bill does, it opens the barn door wide. This is not just with state agencies. If you look at what government entity is, means any city, county, school district, whatever it might be where you believe there's an allegation of fraud. Secondly, it reminds me of the movie I've seen many times, The Trial, about Franz Kafka's The Trial, where allegations are basically given out and then all of a sudden something is happening to you. This is one of the things that I think that could happen here. So I know it's being laid over, and one of the things I would like to suggest is that there be a lot more discussion of documentation when this information is being shared to the different entities, because that's where people, if an agency you're thinking and you as an individual or a proprietor, a family daycare or whatever, you're thinking that the government is doing some things with you that you disagree with or whatever you want to find out, you then can go back and ask for all that data. So I think there needs to be a much broader, wider discussion on that. And as you know, Madam Chair, I probably only got about 10 seconds left. And so my points are made. There needs to be a lot more discussion. And I'm willing to help on any of the, if this bill is going to go forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? I see a hand back there. Please come to the table. And if you would just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony. Please limit it to 2 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Krause. I am the chair of United Veterans Leadership Council. I'm also a VA accredited attorney licensed here in the state of Minnesota. We're here to actually talk about HF 1855, and I just heard about this for the first time. Want to point out a couple things that immediately jump out
at me. So, sir, are your comments to the bill that is before us, 2429?
It is now.
Okay.
So based on that gentleman's testimony, so I also focus on privacy and veteran rights as a veteran rights attorney. And based on the description that I just heard, we're going to be talking about how VA-accredited attorneys may be regulated under 1855, which will have implications with respect to what he's describing in this instant bill, it sounds like. And I want to point out that a lot of what we're doing deals with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and Veteran Records, and if there happens to be an allegation of fraud under the unfair practice that is now being implicated by 1855, it could potentially pull in federal VA records and other documents within this context. I have no further information to share other than a noted concern by a 50-plus-year-old veteran organization here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. All right. Does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone. So we will go to member... I'm sorry. We have that. We also have the DE2. So I will, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I kind of added the DE just for a conversation piece. I don't know that it's actually germane, but it talks about how we handle this fraud issue. And when I read your bill over the weekend, Representative Elkins, I had, you know, some concerns. I talked to you on the House floor about those, and so I ran your bill by Chair Robbins, who's been working on this, and just some discussions, and she said, well, I have this bill, I haven't gotten the draft yet, so I just kind of, in a quick flurry, just had it drafted as an amendment. But I'm wondering if, I mean, we can have a broader discussion now, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if the right thing to do is to necessarily share information, and that may be part of the solution. But I think also when someone suspects some fraud, to go to one central location, whether that's an OLA or whether that's the Office of Inspector General that's being talked about. I certainly understand the intent of what you're trying to do. My concern is that there are no guardrails on this. On your section. So I won't be offering my amendment, but Madam Chair, if I might speak to the bill.
That's yeah, right. Absolutely. Okay. I was just going to ask you, Chair Scott, if you were going to offer the amendment. So you're not offering it. So go ahead, please speak to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you. So there's just so much data sharing here, and anybody can do it. So somebody from HHS can contact someone at the new Department of Family and Children, Family, and that new acronym. But there's no audit trail. We don't know that they ever even share that information necessarily. It could have been a phone call. It's not saying that that the data is, I mean, I guess they are sharing some data. So there's no audit trail. We don't know if the person receiving it ever follows up. And I have, you know, we do, as the previous testifier said, this does allow for sharing with federal agencies. What does that look like? And I would like to see audit trails or something so that we know what information is being shared with whom and what departments. And at the end of the day, two employees, which it looks like to me this allows two employees that just handle grants or what, you know, whatever this is, the data sharing, there's no process involved where it can be tracked over time to see if action is being taken, if the proper information was even shared. So those are my concerns with kind of a little bit of the looseness of the bill. And I'm certainly, you know, open to making the bill workable. And I understand it's part of the governor's plan and you're carrying that bill for him. But I just have some concerns, and those are kind of primarily what they are. Thank you.
All right. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with those concerns. I do think that if data is being shared, that that sharing should be documented, and that's something that we can work on. And I suspect that Assistant Commissioner Christensen might want to weigh in on this as well.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate those concerns, and I think that, you know, certainly additional documentation around data sharing is something that can be discussed. The kind of impetus around this is to make sure that state agencies have the ability to talk to one another, and if we need to tighten that up, that, you know, makes sense. But, you know, the part of the barrier in trying to get at some of this has been, frankly, that agencies aren't able to communicate when they need to.
All right, Chair Scott.
Yeah, I'm, Madam Chair, I would say just the reason that
Representative Elkins,
Assistant Commissioner Christensen are serving on this broader minute task force on data sharing is to flush some of these issues out. So I will be serving with you on the Data Practices Committee this summer, and I think that's probably a topic we might want to take up.
Okay, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both of you. And I think there's definitely some room for improvement in tightening this up. And I was telling Chair Liebling before we got started here, I mean, we all know, the first example I think of where, like, the right arm didn't know what the left arm was doing was 9/11, right? We all found out that the FBI wasn't sharing with whoever else. And so to the extent necessary, and to the extent that we can put parameters around it, certainly we want to stop fraud. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. And I share your concern on this, and I'm glad we're laying it over. And I know that it's moving and being worked on elsewhere, but this is a shared concern, I think. And any other comments or questions? Representative Rarick.
Yeah, just really quickly, I was listening carefully to the answer from the Deputy Commissioner, and you had said that this kind of came out of the state agencies wanting to talk to each other. But Madam Chair, this is widely expansive. This isn't just state agencies. This is, as was testified to, city, county, township, federal, it's everything. So now you're opening that up to everything. And there really isn't parameters at all as to what data specifically is being disclosed, right? It says anything that they think might relate to fraud. Well, that's wildly broad. So I have grave concerns about this too, and it just doesn't seem to be a thought out full package. So I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the bill. I do. I think it might be 6 years and $640 million too late, but one of the questions I have regarding kind of the structure and layout of the entire bill, why do we expect a government to police itself in this? Why would a commissioner who is appointed by a governor go after another that's appointed by a governor when that could be they could be working in a partisan manner to defend themselves?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Representative Engen, Madam Chair. It's not that they want to, you know, go after each other. It's that we have a general problem in state government of being siloed. And sometimes, and the frontline worker pay program is a perfect example, we have to have the agencies cooperating with each other. In that particular case, you know, Department of Labor and Industry was the lead agency, but I couldn't administer the program without working with DEED to get payroll information or a revenue to get income information. They probably would have liked to, you know, go to the Department of Health to get, you know, birth and death information. It's paying benefits to dead people is not a good idea. The way, you know, state government is organized right now, people tend to work in silos, and we need to, in order to work more effectively, to prevent fraud, among other things, we need to facilitate closer cooperation among state agencies, and a big part of that is sharing data. I mean, how do you administer a means-tested program without having a way to check somebody's income?
Okay, Representative Engen, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was being rhetorical. I don't think that they would necessarily police themselves. It seems as if they could have done that in the past, and it hadn't happened. So we need to have an independent aspect to this. If we don't have somebody who's not affiliated with the current administration overseeing this and having some say in it, then I don't think we're going to have much action. So be happy to talk with you, work with you offline on this. Thank you.
Other members? All right, so I have a comment to make on this. I mean, first of all, my understanding is this isn't the only thing in the package, so I don't think we can say, oh, here we're going to do data sharing and that's it. No. That's certainly not it. But I do share concerns with some of my colleagues here. I think this is a very bipartisan issue. It should be a bipartisan issue. You know, I think what's really clear is just when you say fraud, shouldn't mean that opens the door to anything and everything. And I think that's a concern that members have expressed here, right, bipartisanly. We don't want to be like, oh, we're going to allege fraud and then anything goes, share anything, give anything away. And that's not what we want. And yeah. I've heard a commitment here to tighten it up so we don't get there. Because, you know, using that banner, crying fraud, can be a cover for doing some pretty destructive things that are not in the public interest. And we are seeing that right now in real time with Social Security, mm-hmm. where a Doge, Elon Musk, is saying, oh, there's fraud, there's fraud, there's fraud. And there's a real concern that they are destroying the protections and destroying the ability to function of the entire Social Security system. And they're doing this across the entire federal government, as a matter of fact. So I'm very glad that here in Minnesota there is bipartisan commitment to not doing that. Just because we've had some problems, it doesn't mean that we should, like, rip up everything in the name of preventing fraud. There is a tension here between, you know, as Mr. Neumeister said, you know, we're all wearing two hats. We're all wearing both the privacy hat and the transparency hat, and we're trying to have the right balance of hat to get this thing right. And in fact, I would venture to say it's kind of impossible to get it 100% right all the time. It's not the kind of problem you can solve once and for all. You have to stay at it. And that's a project. That's why we have, you know, we'll be working on this forever, honestly, hopefully not with any great big thing having happened in Minnesota, but we always have to be working on this, right? Because people who are evildoers are going to find new ways. I mean, I've just been reading about new scams against elderly people that are happening, right? They find new ways. So we have to keep working on new ways and how we can use our resources to try to use our you know, taxpayer resources in the way they're intended to be used. But it is a big challenge. This is not a good and evil thing. This is people in Minnesota government who didn't have the tools and, you know, bad things happened. People stole from the state of Minnesota. It was not government employees who stole. It was people who took advantage of government programs that could have been tighter, should have been tighter. So I think I appreciate this bill. I appreciate the effort. It does need some work, and I appreciate my colleagues here being willing to engage on that, and let's figure out how to make this work better so that we can stop fraud more easily or find fraud that's happened more easily without completely decimating our the systems that we have to protect people's privacy. So thank you very much. So with that, unless Representative Elkins, you want to say something further, and then we'll lay the bill over.
It's been a very good discussion. We're taking notes, and we will be tightening it up.
All right. Thank you. So House File 2429 is laid over.
Thank you.
All right. We have Representative Howard. So we will call up Representative Howard, House File 2296. And so since Representative Howard is not on the committee, I will move that House File 2296 be placed on the General Register. And I don't think we have an amendment, so welcome to the committee, Representative Howard, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, members of the committee. House File 2296 represents a compromise and ongoing productive dialogue between Minnesota Legal Aid and the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association to tweak legislation that we passed in the previous session regarding how are we making sure that we're protecting survivors of domestic violence who need to break their lease to flee their abuser. So by way of some background, this legislature on a bipartisan and unanimous basis beefed up our protections under the statute that is being proposed to be amended. A tenant experiencing domestic violence is allowed to break their lease if the tenant provides documentation of the violence as required by the statute. This information is, as you might imagine, highly sensitive and if revealed could place the tenant in serious peril. The statute requires that landlords must keep this information strictly confidential. The challenge that we're seeking to address here is that some landlords have argued that the general release form signed by the tenants when the tenant first leased up override the requirement in the statute. We don't think that's appropriate, but we're seeking to clarify that to make certain and crystal clear that the requirement in Section 504B that landlords keep information about that abuse necessary to reveal, keep that information private in order to protect the safety of the tenant. There's no opposition to the bill, and I want to thank Minnesota Legal Aid and Minnesota Multi-Housing for their work collaboratively to get to this place on this simple bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. Mr. Elwood, did you care to testify on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Runner with Legal Aid. Just want to thank Representative Howard for carrying the bill and the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association for always working so collaboratively with us, and happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. Member comments? Discussion? Representative Rarick.
I just have a really quick question. So you had talked about this being a tweak of a previous bill. When did this basically allowance of for someone to leave a lease, get out of the lease, when did that go into law?
Representative Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Rarick, the bill to allow victims of domestic violence to break their lease first came into effect in 2007. And over the years, the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association Legal Aid kept working to make it actually more workable and make sure that the landlords would receive, payment for the month that the tenant left. And so we tweaked it again in 2013 and tweaked it again in 2023 or 4, I can't remember.
Representative Rarick?
Just really quick, thank you, Madam Chair. It's just confounding to me because I thought this had been in law for decades. And so it seems weird to me that we are now just getting to the point where we can keep that data private, because it certainly is dangerous if you could address that.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Rarick, sorry for the confusion. This piece of the bill, Subdivision 2, has been in effect for a while. It's just that what we've seen happen over the last couple of years is that once we put this in statute, some landlords were arguing in court that oh, no, the tenant signed a general release form when she first leased up, and so we didn't violate this law. There's nothing wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. When, in fact, the intent of this statute is to make sure that this supersedes anything else. And so it just wasn't clear. And so that's all this bill does, is clarify that this provision supersedes any general release form previously signed. That's what we're trying to do this session.
Representative Eric.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was very confused because I thought this was in law for decades. So now I understand. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. Thank you, Chair Howard, for the bill. And I really appreciate the attention to tenants' rights over the last few years. And like Chair Rarick said, it's surprising sometimes the things that we uncover that have just been happening. But I'm glad to see a quick fix to protect rights and protect information, because I know tenants are people who have a variety of forms that they're filling out a lot more than a typical homeowner might. And so there's a lot of data out there on renters that's accessible. So I appreciate the protection of the data. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Howard. I echo the Representative Howard, excuse me. I echo the thanks for this bill. And I think that I don't actually think I've seen a bill like this since I've been here, which, you know, when I was reading this and doing my background on it, this, it's like already illegal, and we're adding a paragraph that says basically like, no, we really mean it. It's actually illegal. And I guess my question is, you know, landlords weren't following the law. We are clarifying to say, you know, follow the law. So what are we what happens next time, right? Like, is it who is what's the enforcement mechanism for bad acting landlords who are putting people at risk?
Representative Howard.
First, Representative Fink, you did a better job describing my bill than I did. So thank you. But hopefully clarifying this is going to, you know, take out any ambiguity that would result in, you know, breaking the statute. But this should make it clearer to hold landlords accountable if they do now break the statute.
All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you. I hope that is true. I will trust your judgment on that. Thank you.
Thank you
for the bill.
Okay. Any other? Representative Scott.
Just real quickly, Representative Finke. I'll tell you what, we do a lot of no, we really mean it bills around here. This isn't the first one, and it won't be the last. So we do an awful lot of that around here. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Well said. All right. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question, and if you don't have the answer, that's fine. I'm just curious. Do we have any idea of the scope of who this affects, like how many leases get broken in this manner or how many people it would help?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, we don't have the exact numbers. This is one of those statutes that doesn't necessarily affect a whole lot of people, but those that it does affect has an enormous impact for those individuals. And I also want to make it clear that this is not, you know, the landlords aren't running to the courthouse to say that they didn't break the law. This is not. But we've had these experiences, and I think Representative Finke, to your point, yeah, it already said that. You're absolutely right. But it left open an argument that a lawyer could make to say that it's ambiguous, it's not crystal clear. And the reason this is really helpful, I think, and why this will probably do what we're intended, is that when, you know, there's a dispute, legal aid lawyers or any lawyer representing the tenant can point to this and say, hey, you can't make the other argument anymore because this is pretty clear. So that's what this really is intended to do, is to help attorneys representing these clients prevent those arguments and this ambiguity. That's exactly what this is for.
All right. Any follow-up? Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew the motion that House File 2296 be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is going to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Howard. Okay. All right, next we have House File 2543, Representative Ryer. And the motion is that House File, and I will move because she, Representative Ryer, is not on the committee, so that motion will be that House File 2543 be re-referred to Commerce, Finance, and Policy. And there is an amendment. And there is an A1 amendment. And Representative Ryer, did you want to move the A1 right away?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so I will move the A1 amendment. Do you want to just say a few words to that, Representative Breyer?
Yes, thank you. The amendment adjusts dates. You'll recall last year we passed legislation that modernized and improved the garnishment processes in Minnesota. And those change processes had an effective date of April 1st of this year and also required forms revisions, which is what we're seeing today. So this amendment aligns the dates when these forms have to be up on the Minnesota Court's website and in use, along with a new effective date to make sure that the forms are there when people are able to use them. And then there's a retroactive date, just in case these aren't final legally by April 1st.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or discussion to the A1? All right, all those, so the A1 has been moved, so all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Two-year bill as amended.
All right, thank you. So hard to understand forms are one of the most pervasive annoyances we all face. They can also have serious consequences if people make mistakes on them when stakes are high. For example, when they're dealing with financial problems that led to garnishment. The changes in garnishment processes last year meant that the forms would have to be altered, so we took the opportunity to also improve the usability by incorporating principles of plain language into the revision process. House File 2543 brings forward the results of this work. As required, the Attorney General's Office led a process with stakeholders from across the garnishment process, the courts, attorneys, banks, employers, consumers, and advocacy groups. The core team included a specialist in plain language. But three types of content changes were needed: updating exemptions, updating definitions, and incorporating the new wage garnishment tiers. Once this was done, plain language revisions were made with consideration to simplified language and clearer layout and organization. And finally, as you'll see in a letter to this effect in your packet, the subject matter expert signed off on the forms, confirming that the content of the forms was unchanged. So I'd like to give you an example of language simplification. The original is online 4.20 to 4.23, and it reads, if, after receipt of this notice, you in bad faith take action to frustrate the execution levy, thus requiring the judgment creditor to petition the court to resolve the problem, you will be liable to the judgment creditor for costs and reasonable attorney's fees plus an amount not to exceed $100. That would be the old version. Now on the form, someone will see, if you get this notice, then do something in bad faith to try or block or stop the levy, and the creditor has to take you to court because of it, you'll have to pay the creditor's costs and reasonable lawyer's fees and a fine up to $100. That's really typical of the types of changes you'll see throughout this large packet of legislation. And a good example of layout and organization changes is right on page 2 and 3. The original from 2.29 to 2.32 has a hard-to-read list in paragraph form. There are 10 items in there with all of their acronyms. And instead, that's struck, and they're listed in bullet form so people can find more easily. So I'm hopeful that changes like these will make a stressful situation for consumers a little easier, and I ask for your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Breyer. And you have a couple of testifiers. And
yes, Madam Chair, they're here in case there are questions.
Oh, in case of questions. Okay, so neither of you wants to just testify on the bill. Okay, so is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. No one's fleeing either. That's probably because of the plain language. So, member discussion. Okay, well, I just would say that I appreciate this effort. I have to say the use of really overly complicated language is kind of one of my pet peeves. It's really unfair to people. It's sometimes even I, a lawyer, have trouble reading some of the stuff in our statutes and in forms, and you know, and I really feel for people because we shouldn't be putting barriers in front of them. So I really appreciate this effort. And thank you for working on it, Representative Ryer. Anyone else want to comment? Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems like, I mean, the packet's pretty thick. There's a lot of forms in there that have been revamped. So if the two testifiers who refused to speak, if they were in on making those changes, I want to thank you because that was a yeoman's work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Any closing comments, Representative Ryer?
No, I appreciate the support. I think work like this makes a difference for people, as you said, Madam Chair. And I would like to see us carry this kind of work into other aspects of our system.
All right, great. Well, thank you. So with that, I will renew the motion that House File 2543, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Thank you. So Representative Ryer has the next bill as well, House File 2566. And so I will move that House File 2566 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. And there is an A2 amendment. And Representative Ryer, did you want to move the A2 right now?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so I will move the A2 on behalf of Representative Ryer, and could you just describe briefly what it does?
Yes, thank you. So above all, it gets the bill into the shape I'd like it in. It matches it up to the Senate version, changes that were made there. It also incorporates a little bit of stakeholder feedback and explicitly allows complaints related to a civil or criminal complaint to be shared with the Attorney General's office or other agencies.
All right. Any discussion to the A2? All right. All in favor of adoption of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. So, Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2543, the Minnesota Business Filing Fraud Prevention Act, is an important step in protecting Minnesotans from business identity fraud. Bad actors can hijack a legitimate business or create fake ones in someone else's name, often chosen by chance with no connection to the perpetrator. Victims often don't realize what's happened until they're facing bills, legal troubles, or tax liabilities for a business they never owned or for actions their actual business did not take.
And Representative Ryer, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. You said 2543. That was the last bill. I just want to make sure everyone's clear. This is 2566.
Yes.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. So the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State handles phone calls daily for Minnesotans who are suddenly dealing with this crime without a clear answer of why and how to clear their name. The office also lacks the statutory ability to help beyond aiding law enforcement who may investigate. Article 1 of this bill creates a clear process for handling fraudulent filings, making it easier to literally correct the record and unwind the damage. It's near impossible to pass laws at the speed that criminals can abuse systems, so having a direct path to challenge and remove wrongful filings ensures that victims can reclaim their businesses and identities without long delays and costly legal representation. Article 2 seeks to address another common issue. The office receives calls from business owners across the state about solicitations offering to complete operating requirements for a fee. The office has seen examples of solicitations that look nearly identical to and could very easily have been mistaken for official communications. These deceptive solicitations can easily convince business owners that they should pay for a service that they could easily do for free or lower cost on the office's website. So now I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Bethke, Deputy General Counsel at the Office of the Secretary of State, to provide more detail about the process laid out in the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Wonderful. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Bethke, and I'm the Deputy General Counsel for the Secretary of State. We've been working on this language for a couple of years. We're really pleased with the shape it's taken. I believe there are a few letters of support in your packets. So thank you to Representative Ryer for carrying the bill, and thank you very much to the committee for hearing the bill today. The main portion of the bill creates a process for our office to be able to remove fraudulent filings from the business filing database. Right now, we don't have that authority unless someone goes to court and gets a court order. So this bill creates a process that allows us to remove fraudulent filings after going through some steps to ensure due process. I've been asked to focus my remarks on Sections 8 and 9 of Article 1, since that's what's in this committee's jurisdiction, I believe. So I will start there. But happy to take questions or talk about other parts of the bill afterwards. Section 8 covers the judicial review process after the office determines whether a filing is fraudulent or not. A party aggrieved by the office's determination can appeal in district court. This language is similar to language used by other agencies for appeals of administrative determinations. And I'll just note that the author's amendment removes the second sentence of paragraph E in the underlying bill. There was some concern that a party might have reasons to need to introduce additional evidence at the appeals stage, so we deleted that sentence. Section 9 is regarding the classification of data, which is also amended, largely just reorganized by the author's amendment. A lot of the data submitted by the parties throughout the process would be considered not public because we don't want to discourage folks from making these complaints for fear that personal information about themselves or their businesses could become public in a data request. However, the final order from our office would be public, as well as redacted versions of filings. And the office could, of course, share additional data with the Attorney General, law enforcement, or other agencies as part of an investigation into the underlying fraud. So that's the overview of those two sections, but happy to take questions.
All right. Thank you. Did you have any other testifiers, Representative Ryer?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone. Okay, with that, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like you've put a lot of thought into the potential for this new process to be abused. I see reference to harassment potentially being a motivation for somebody to use this in bad faith. Can you expound upon how your office goes about trying to determine whether or not a complaint that would be submitted under this bill is legitimate or not?
Ms. Bethke?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question, Representative Hudson. So the process has several steps. There's, you know, several different notice provisions for, you know, when someone makes a complaint under this process for the business to provide information, you know, if they believe that filing, you know, was made legitimately and is not fraudulent. The office had, so the way the process works, it starts with the initial submission of the complaint saying that this filing is fraudulent, and our office takes an initial look at that complaint, and that's probably the language that you saw where we have the ability to reject the complaint if we believe that it was made, you know, not in good faith or, you know, for purposes of harassment. In talking with other states, particularly Colorado, that has a similar process in their law, the fraudulent filings have a real pattern to them. And so we believe that when our staff makes these determinations, it will be pretty clear, you know, when there are filings made or complaints made about filings that are in a harassing manner.
Representative Hudson? Oh, okay, good. Okay. Other... Oh, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in this process that you just described, do you do a site visit to see if that business is, you know, is it an empty warehouse with nothing in it? Or, you know, do you do that as a kind of check to see if they're legitimate?
Ms. Befke?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question. We do not. A lot of times when these fraudulent filings are made, it might, you know, change the address of a business to somewhere in California or, you know, like very far outside of our state. So there's not a process in the bill for a site visit or anything like that. I don't know that we would have the sort of staff capacity to do that kind of work.
Representative Frerich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a suggestion from the Fraud Committee. We have two members that serve on the Fraud Committee here. I'm just looking to make sure. Making sure there wasn't a Democrat also. So fraud appears in all sort of ways. Businesses, nonprofits, just all kinds of different ways. So one of the best ways to get at that, I understand if they're in California, but one of the best ways to get at it is to actually go physically there and put your eyes on it, talk to people, see if that's a real business or just literally an empty lot, which we have found in our fraud work. The address is an empty lot. The address is a warehouse that's supposed to be a daycare center or whatever it is. I mean, so there's I'll talk to the author. So I would highly recommend talking to the stakeholders and possibly adding some sort of component that it's a you're the author. Some sort of component that is actually getting somebody in that space to actually look at it, verify it, because I could see this going all kinds of different directions. Again, as we've been wading through all of the fraud that's happened in Minnesota, which is rampant, unfortunately, there are actors that will abuse this in all kinds of ways. So I appreciate the fact that we want to get fraudulent businesses off of the Secretary of State website, because that certainly is one of the checks that we use when I'm looking at nonprofits, and you know they also do that. So I look at the filings both in the AG's office and the Secretary of State's office. So I often use that site, just so you know. But I would have strong concerns if we're going to be just doing this over the phone or over Zoom or, you know, just through paper, through email. Like, that's frankly not enough to verify, in my opinion. Thank you.
Ms. Befke?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate that point. We're certainly, you know, open to continuing discussion about how the process works. I will say that the process, it's really not intended for us to be removing filings in sort of close cases. I think sometimes someone will make a filing and there will be an allegation that it's fraudulent, but it ends up being like a, you know, a family business and the family members are arguing about the ownership of the business or something like that. In that kind of situation, we would not declare the filing fraudulent. We would leave it in place, and folks would have the opportunity to appeal in district court to have a court make that determination. So I certainly appreciate the feedback.
All right, thank you. Other comments and questions? All right, seeing none, Representative Ryer, any closing remarks?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the questions. I would just like to close with that I think it's important to protect business owners and individuals from fraud. It does build their trust in our system and keeps the business community strong. So I ask for your support.
All right. So I will renew the motion that House File 2566, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you. And next on the agenda, we have House File 1855, Representative Greenman. And since Representative Greenman is not on the committee, I will move that House File 1855 be re-referred back to the Veterans and Military Affairs Division. So let's see, we don't have any amendments to the bill. So Representative Greenman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. It's nice to be in Judiciary again this year. I'm glad to be here to present House File 1855. This is a legislative response to the exploitive practices that the U.S. Inspector General for the VA, the Veterans Service Organizations like the VFW and DAV, the Attorney General's Office, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs have all warned is a rapidly increasing fraud scheme targeting Minnesota veterans. We had about an hour and 45 minutes of hearings on this bill in Veterans Committee, so I'm going to keep the brief, my remarks brief to the problem we're talking about and then the consumer penalties within the committee's jurisdiction. This problem, in a nutshell, is that an unaccredited businesses and people are profiting off of veterans who are often vulnerable and desperate to get the benefits that they have earned from the U.S. government. To be clear, filing a claim for veterans' benefits is free, as it should be. In fact, federal law prohibits charging a veteran to prepare or submit their initial claim. Yet we've seen an industry spring up targeting vulnerable veterans and their families with promises of speeding up the process, guaranteeing benefits, and other promises that they have no way of delivering. For a price, often a cut of the back pay or benefits, this is compensation that these veterans have earned and taxpayers have appropriated for those veterans. Like other areas of fraud, and you were just talking about the way we're talking about fraud, I think Representative Rarick mentioned the Fraud Committee. In the House, we've spent a lot of time talking about stopping fraud, stopping public benefits fraud. And this abusive industry exploded with the expansion of benefits like we've seen in other areas. In 2022, the PAC Act was passed by Congress, and it was a really important bill that provided additional benefits for folks who were exposed to Agent Orange, burn pits, and others. And as with other predatory industries, what we see with attempts to regulate and make the markets more transparent is often fierce resistance. Self-interested parties, lobbyists, companies operating outside the state who've made a business on targeting and marketing to vulnerable veterans and siphoning off those taxpayer dollars meant to go for that, those benefits. But this is a modest solution, this bill, 1855, that addresses the issue. It continues to allow for-profit companies to provide veteran services if they're accredited by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and have a written fee agreement. It prohibits making guarantees of benefits, and under Subdivision 4, this committee's jurisdiction, it gives veterans and the legal tools under consumer protection laws to vindicate their rights when they've been ripped off. This bill brings this practice under Minnesota consumer protection laws, including allowing private enforcement by the veterans themselves, in addition to an injunction and other civil remedies that are currently available in other kinds of consumer protections. It just makes sense that the veterans who are ripped off by claim sharks and others should be able to use the consumer protection laws, use the laws of Minnesota to vindicate their rights. And with that, Madam Chair, I think I will turn it over to the assistant or to the Deputy Commissioner Ben Johnson from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
All right, thank you, Representative Greenman. And just to be clear, the jurisdiction of this committee would be Subdivision 4 of the bill, the penalties provision. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, members. My name is Ben Johnson. I am Deputy Commissioner for Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. As always, Representative Greenman has done an excellent job outlining the concerns that the agency has with regards to this issue. I want to thank the legislature for passing the Veterans Disclosure Bill back in 2017, led by members of the GOP at that time. Senator Bruce Anderson carried this bill. And the legislative intent at that time was intended to offer additional protections to veterans seeking benefits claims support. The disclosure bill was at that point defined as we need to make sure that veterans understand that the benefits that they are entitled to, they can receive support in activating and securing those benefits for free through the existing resources available to them. As Representative Greenman has outlined in this case, for the jurisdiction of this committee, our biggest concern is ensuring that the best resources are available to help veterans through the protections offered by the courts and through the Attorney General's office. I also want to call out and thank Representative Bliss and the team, Representative Duran, about the on their work in supporting this bill moving forward to continue to have an opportunity to work out some of the areas of concern registered by their side. Not today.
All right, thank you. And I have other testifiers on the list, but could I just ask you before you step away to just to talk a little bit about the change in the penalty section that is before the committee? I don't know if that would be Mr. Baker if, or Representative Greenman, if you would care to do it.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, or Mr. Johnson. I was, I'm looking at the wrong place on my list, but Mr. Johnson or does somebody want to just address that piece because that is why the bill is here?
If I may, Madam Chair, and good morning. My name is John Baker. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. I'm their executive director. I'm retired United States Marine Corps, and I am a lawyer myself. As Representative Greenman as, and as Deputy Commissioner Johnson said, this initial law has been on the books since 2017 with a penalty, civil penalties, which included $1,000 per violation. When I became the executive director 2 years ago, we started sending cases to the Attorney General's office. Before that, it hadn't been enforced. And the AG's office told me at that time that they have a consumer protection statute that fits this very well. So that's one of the reasons that we're moving this to the consumer protection statute, that this gives not only the Attorney General's office more leeway, but it also gives a veteran a private right of action, as well as the Attorney General can submit an injunction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you for that explanation. Okay, so we have some public testifiers who have signed up to testify, and so we'll need you to give them some space, gentlemen, if you would. And so the first one on the agenda here is John Blomstrom. And we're going to ask each of the testifiers to please keep it to 2 minutes. We just have 15 minutes left in the agenda here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Blomstrom. I am the Government Relations and Public Affairs Manager for Veterans Guardian, a private VA claims consulting firm. I'm also a United States Marine Corps veteran. Before I begin, would just like to thank the service of my fellow veterans sitting here in this room on both sides of this issue. While I think Representative Greenman's bill is well-intended, it is unfortunately falls short in terms of providing and protecting a veteran's right to choose. We definitely support the criminal penalties from a fraudulent practices perspective, but feel that addressing a federal problem such as accreditation at the state level is just untenable. And so while, again, we really strongly support the consumer protections pieces that are here, would like to be able to defend ourselves in the fact that our business does everything to the letter of the law as we interpret it under 38 CFR 5901. We do not act as agents or attorneys. We provide a service that is contingency-based and ensure that we work well within the letter of the law to protect veterans and their right to choose how they get their VA claims done. I do want to thank members of both parties in coming to the table and trying to figure a compromise out, but as it is written right now, HF 1855 falls short again, would limit a veteran's choice in the state of Minnesota, not broaden it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. I do just want to note that I think those issues are the issues more properly for the Veterans Committee.
Sure.
And that's where the bill will be going.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Benjamin Krause. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Benjamin Krause. I am a veteran rights attorney who happens to be federally VA accredited. I have represented veterans in appeals before the VA and federal court in this federal practice area for over a decade. I'm also a disabled veteran and chair of United Veterans Leadership Council, and we do not support this bill as written, as it creates seriously unintended consequences. The bill's Subdivision 4 penalty applies the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act under Chapter 325F to technical violations of the advertising disclosure law, including blogs and podcasts. To be clear, Chapter 325F generally regulates merchandise sales, not legal services of attorneys, which instead fall under Chapter 481. The bill's supporters rightly want it to regulate claim sharks, and it also, and also VA-accredited attorneys for charging federally regulated fees at the Department of Veterans Affairs. But this bill was not timely referred to the Minnesota State Bar Association for review and approval, now creating a catch-22. And here's just one example. If I'm featured on a live podcast like Three Clicks Media up in Stillwater, Minnesota, and we promote one of my recent wins at U.S. Supreme Court, but we don't also promote CVSO services, that could now be consumer fraud for an unfair practice. But if we promote CVSOs in that context, we risk false advertising, which may also be fraud because CVSOs aren't authorized to represent veterans in benefits appeals at the U.S. Supreme Court. This creates a no-win situation for VA-accredited attorneys. Regulatory risk like this is why I stopped taking paid Minnesota veteran cases years ago, and I'm not alone. There are only 10 VA-accredited attorneys in Minnesota with a dedicated veteran benefits law practice, and three have already opted out. Many more may follow. Minnesota veterans are underserved, and this bill pushes us further in the wrong direction. The simple fix: amend Subdivision 5 to exempt federal VA-accredited individuals. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Master Sergeant Francis White. And then Brian Lewis. So maybe you'd like to come up at the same time, Mr. Lewis, if you're here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. To begin with, I am a retired United States Air Force Master Sergeant, a practicing attorney, a VA-accredited attorney, and I have stopped servicing Minnesota veterans for the very reasons that Mr. Krause said. I'm here to speak to you on Subdivision 4 and the proposed language that has changed, and I urge you not to change it. For the lawyers among you, you will understand that when a court reviews a statute, it looks at the statute and considers that the legislature acted and knew what it was doing when it acted. When HF 1209 was initially passed in 2017, you put in a provision there that was so draconian, it prevented me and many other attorneys, VA-accredited attorneys and VA-accredited agents, from representing Minnesota veterans. That language is clear on its face. It is so draconian that when that was implemented, to reference another movie quote, it was like the quote from Aliens, where you decided to take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. Over the last 2 years, I have secured hundreds of thousands of dollars in VA benefits for veterans, none in Minnesota. Leave the language as it is, because as you, Madam Chair, stated, the use of overly complicated language defeats your purpose. That language is so simple, so draconian, that even a CVSO or any other unaccredited layperson can understand the consequences of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Lewis. I'm a attorney in private practice in the Twin Cities area. I speak in my personal capacity only. And I'm here to oppose HF 1855 as written. The reality is this bill, while on its face being attributed to trying to rein in claim sharks, is reining in licensed and VA-accredited attorneys. What it is doing is regulating the practice of law. And Subdivision 4, the version in 2017,
knocked a lot of VA-accredited attorneys out, and this bill seeks to finish the job. The penalties now will include that if I was to take a Minnesota client for VA appeals purposes, and I will not because of the statute as written, that if I don't secure that veteran what they think is the proper rating, I could be targeted for a lawsuit. And this is a niche area of law, and I am virtually certain VA-accredited attorneys were not consulted when doing this law, because the penalty section also impermissibly steps on the VA's toes under the authority of 38 U.S.C. 511A.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. So is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So we will go to member discussion. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little disappointed. For some reason, I was told this bill was going to be laid over today because we didn't come to an agreement. That's news to me, so that's very disappointing. This is nonpartisan at this point, or I should say very partisan at this point. The Democrat author has attempted to work with us. There was no movement. We were told we would move it forward with only under the guys that would be working together to come to a solution, and that didn't happen. So it is my I just feel very, very rushed on this. If we would have maybe had another 6 weeks, say, we could have worked through something on this, but this is not ready for prime time, and we will not support moving it forward.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's the reason that it is moving back to Veterans Committee. We had one of three meetings that are scheduled, in that meeting we had an hour and 45-minute conversation about language. I had been under the impression that this was a work in progress, but if you want to stop the progress of that, that is not a choice I can make. What I think is important to me is that we have had conversations. I know they're having conversations in the Senate. The conversations about the bill language, not the 2017 language, which is a different conversation, actually are the jurisdiction of the Veterans Committee. That's why it's going to the Veterans Committee, not the General Register. My intention and the work has always been to continue working on it. The idea of laying it over in the committee that's not of jurisdiction just because you don't want to advance it forward, to me, is where the progress stops. I want to continue working on this bill. I think that the challenge is that there are some accreditation, which is, again, not the jurisdiction of this committee. That is really where right now it feels like we're at a roadblock. We got to keep working through that. My understanding is, and we are working on another meeting. My LA started working on another meeting after the meeting to follow up yesterday. So we're going to continue doing that, whether or not I'm going to continue trying to do that work, whether or not you all want to vote this out. I think it's really important that we show the forward progress. So I appreciate the motion to send the bill back to the Committee of Jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Which was always the agreement.
Representative Bliss, anything further? Or we'll go to Representative Duran. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am also disappointed in this. I figured that we would be working on this, and you know, I thought we had a good meeting yesterday, and I thought that would be, you know, something that we would address. The section in this is section 4, which was the testimony on, and I thought we agreed that we would work on something like that before we would move anything forward, and we kind of expressed our concerns about moving anything forward past this point yesterday when we spoke with you. I'm not in support of this bill the way it is. I haven't been, and I don't know where that came from. So I've been willing to reach out and talk with people and, you know, work with as many people as we can just to get some good legislation passed. And right now it doesn't look like that's being reciprocated back, you know. There doesn't look like there's any movement here. So I will not be supporting this as well. And thank you. Right. Madam Chair, I request a roll call as well, please.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. Okay. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And just a couple comments on the bill. First, thank you, Representative Greenman, for your work in this area. I think ultimately what we hopefully all share is the opinion that these systems are really complicated to navigate, and folks who should be getting benefits should have quick and easy access to them without even having to go pay an attorney to do a lot of these things. And I think, you know, we heard other bills earlier today that cleans up the system and makes things easier. It is my hope that folks who do this work would actually hope that we could write laws that make it so easy for folks to get through this process that they wouldn't even have to exist in doing that work anymore. A lot of us who do service work hope that sometime the system will work us out of a job because people are getting what they need without us being a middle person there. And I would just say, you know, as it relates to Subdivision 4 in this committee, I'm seeing opposition letters from other states, Missouri, North Carolina, wherever. That's how we want our laws to be in Minnesota. I support that we're trying to strengthen that because people who are not getting their benefits adequately should not be spending time and money on this process. We should avoid that as much as possible. I think this helps us get there. Thank you.
All right, so members, we're going to run over by a few minutes, so I've got Representative Engen, then Scott. I'm going to make a brief comment, and then we'll go back to let Representative Greenman close up. So Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first off, I want to preface this by saying I'm not a veteran. I haven't donned the uniform. I haven't gone and served my country in that sense. But I've talked to some folks that have, and I've heard some really compelling stories as to why this legislation as it currently sits needs change. There are a lot of good actors out there who are providing a service that, quite frankly, has provided better benefits for veterans. Especially with long wait times, having gone through the VA, they need help. They need to navigate. And it seems like we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater on this. I hope that there is some willingness to listen to our concerns and address those with sincerity and in good faith to try to get something that's workable and takes out the folks who are the bad actors. But if we're just going to take a sledgehammer to an issue that could have been addressed with a scalpel, that doesn't seem like necessarily good legislation for me, and it doesn't seem like it's good legislation for veterans. So hopefully it changes going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been around here a while, and I've never served on the Veterans Committee, but I will say that historically what I've always seen is veterans bills don't become law unless they're passed bipartisanly. And so that is a concern for me here, that it seems to be, you know, being pushed through. And the testimony about how many attorneys are already unwilling, even certified ones, are unwilling to help our veterans right now is of great concern. If there's 10 or fewer, you know, in the state of Minnesota, that's just not adequate. So if rather than fencing more people out, I think we need to go after the bad actors and just maybe strengthen those penalties rather than having this hard line of certification. So those are my comments, members, and it's concerning to me that we're at this place with a veterans bill.
Thank you, Representative Scott. So I would say before I let Representative Greenman have the final word that this seems like a really good discussion for the Veterans Committee, which I have not served on either. And I'm very grateful that many of you are, and I think you should have this discussion in the Veterans Committee. Obviously, the bill got voted out and got here. I don't know exactly how that happened when you all are opposed to it, but I hope that we can send it back to Veterans Committee. It's not going to the floor. It clearly won't leave the Veterans Committee unless people vote for it. So I hope that we can send it back and let you all work on it and work this out. So I really have no opinion about what works best for veterans. It's kind of not my thing to know that. But I hope that you all can get together and figure that out, because I think our veterans deserve to get their benefits with the least possible hassle and expense. So thank you. Representative Greenman, do you want to close before we vote?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as somebody who served on the Veterans Committee for the last 4 years, this is a conversation we started having last year when a Veterans Service Officer, Dr. Christy Janico, brought this bill because of how much they're seeing the problem. This is a top priority. The Commander's Task Force, which is the VFW, the DAV, and others for folks who are work in the veteran space, and something that I have had lots of conversations in my own district where I have the VA and the Minneapolis Veterans Home with veterans and folks who serve veterans as service officers directly. This issue that we're seeing, like as we talk about fraud in other spaces, is rapidly expanding, and it is stealing benefits from veterans. It is defrauding taxpayers that have made a commitment to veterans, both the benefits but also providing the free service through a veteran service officer through to help with their claims. Our job is to regulate that industry, not let a for-profit unaccredited industry. There, we have heard some conversations about lawyers. That is a different conversation. Those lawyers you've heard from are accredited. The conversation we're having about accreditation is different and is for the Veterans Committee. With that, member, I actually think this is an incredibly important bill when we're talking about fighting fraud and protecting people from keeping their protecting Minnesotans and their benefits. This is a core part of that package. It has been bipartisan. I hope we pass it in a bipartisan way. I think the Commander's Task Force would hope that we do that, but we need to have partnership to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so I will renew the motion that House File 1855 be re-referred to the Veterans and Military Affairs Division, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Chair Scott.
No.
Scott, nay. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Vice Chair Hudson.
No.
Hudson, nay. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, nay. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Curran, aye. Excuse me. I did this wrong. Sorry, one sec. All right. Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Duran, nay. Representative Engen.
No.
Engen, nay. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Finke.
Aye.
Finke, aye. Representative Mahmoud.
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Rarick.
No.
Rarick, nay. Representative Steer.
No.
Steer, nay. There are seven ayes and seven nays.
All right. There being seven ayes and seven nays, the motion does not prevail, and so the bill will be laid over. And thank you, Representative Greenman. So with that, we are at the end of our time. We are adjourned.